Sermons from the Journey is the audio podcast of the weekly message preached by Reverend Becca Gorell, pastor at Lebanon United Methodist Church in Lebanon, New Hampshire, and blogging at pastorbecca.com. Thanks for listening.
What do you want to be when you grow up? That's what I asked the kids. Sometimes people still ask us these things, even those of us who have supposedly grown up. What do you want to be when you grow up? And from a very young age, although as we saw, right, as we saw, there is a point before which the answer to that question isn't clear. There is a point at which a child doesn't know that we mean, what job do you want to do? And they might answer anything. They might answer a tiger. They might answer loving. But by a certain age, which varies child by child, everybody's pretty clear that when somebody says to you, what do you want to be when you grow up? They mean, what job do you want to do? Because in so many ways, we define ourselves by the job that we do. By what we do for money, even. So folk who work really, really hard at home or really, really hard in retirement often say, almost apologetically, if you ask them, what do you do? They say, oh, I'm retired. They don't say, I volunteer 50 hours a week. They say, I'm retired. Or, I'm a stay-home parent. They don't say, I cook and clean and manage household for a vast number of very messy people. They say, I'm a stay-home parent. And anyone who's ever lost a job or worked in a job about which you're not 100% comfortable talking, there are lots of reasons for that. Maybe it's just not a job that you feel uses your skills and your gifts. Maybe it's not the job you know you were expected to do in your family growing up. There was maybe something that there had been an expectation and then you didn't do that. Maybe you're a spy, I don't know. But there could be reasons to not talk about it, and sometimes it's hard, it's painful because we do this, right? It's not only what we ask young folk what they want to do, what they want to be when they grow up, but we do this when you meet somebody. That's kind of one of the first questions. So what do you do? And that's when people respond, oh. And they supply their career, they supply their vocation, they supply their current job, or they say, I'm retired. And we don't mention all the things that we do. That's not what we do, that's not who we are, certainly. But it's a huge part of how we define ourselves, and it can be a very painful thing, especially if there's been a loss of job or if there's been some sort of negativity about that. Every once in a while, I find myself in a group of people who are not of the opinion that women can be clergy. I come from a half of a family that's Catholic. So there are a great many people who are not of the opinion that women should be clergy, and when I'm asked what I do, sometimes it's not worth the argument. And I say, oh, I work for a church. And they go, oh, okay. That's okay. That's okay, right? That's also not what I do. And it's certainly not who I am, right? I was at the Board of Ordained Ministry meeting this past week down in Andover, Massachusetts, and we had some time after long days of interviewing candidates for ordination. And a colleague of mine, we were all sitting around, so everybody at the table, there was one person at the table who was a lay person, but everyone else at the table was clergy, and we all kind of knew that. So what do you do was a silly question, right? Because everybody had the same job. But this colleague asked me, so Becca, what do you do for fun? And he had to clarify that, right? He had to put that on the end. What do you do for fun? But I thought, wouldn't it be great if we all just answered that question first when someone asked you, what do you do? If we answered, what do you do for fun? You know, and so I started talking about, you know, we have a kayak and we like to, you know, walk and look at the leaves this time of year and, you know, all the stuff with the kids. And, you know, I used to do taekwondo, but since I hurt my foot, I can't do that for a little while. And used to paint, but since I don't know, like left college, I haven't had time to do that, but I love to do it. You know, what do you do? And there was this whole wealth of information that I got to share. And of course, then we start asking other folks around the table, what do you do for fun? You get a much better sense of who somebody is that way, right? A much better sense of what's deep in our person. What do you do that gives you joy? What do you do that feeds your spirit? That's a better answer to who we are. But as a culture, as a society, we tend to define ourselves by our job. And that sells us short in a great way, in a large way, not like a good great way, a large great way. It sells us short. In part, this is a transformation that's happened in what we used to call, or we might still call, the American dream. There used to be a dream, what we refer to of as the American dream. We don't mean, you know, like some of the really great dreams about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We mean this dream. We mean the dream that you could enter the workforce as an adult with a reasonable amount of training for your vocation, but that might not necessarily require a particular degree, depending on the vocation. You could enter your job as an adult, that it would be something that you love, so that when you say, what do? That answer to what you do for fun or that's fulfilling, and that answer to what you do for work might have some overlap. Wouldn't that be nice? For some people, they do. But that you could do that, and that maybe one person in the household could work and could do that and could earn money, and that would be enough for a household, maybe two. Certainly no more than two full-time jobs for any household. Nobody needs to work three jobs, a person, or anything like that. Nobody needs to start their adult life so burdened by the debt of undergraduate and graduate education that they feel like they'll never kind of climb up out of that sinkhole. No, that what we do for work is fulfilling, is good, and leaves us plenty of time to be in our community, in our family, doing the things we love. That's a dream. That's an American dream, right? It's great. It's good if you can get it. But oh boy, that's not always what happens. In fact, that's rarely what happens. And even when it does happen and things seem to be going well, life has a way of happening then and shaking things up and changing things up. But we don't even talk about that good stuff anymore as if it's a dream, do we? How do we talk about the 9-to-5? We talk about it as the grindstone. Got our nose to the grindstone, that which wears us down. Or, even better, the rat race. Oh, that's a good image. What do you do for work? Oh, I run in the rat race, is what it feels like, right? This struggle, this strain that stretches and pulls us too much to try to make ends meet. That dream has become a kind of nightmare, a kind of nightmare for us to try to, it's like one of those chase nightmares. Anybody get all those chase nightmares where you're like running and you feel like you'll never get away or you'll never catch up or there's obviously something going on in your conscious life when that happens, but you know, that feeling of, we just can't be enough. We just can't have enough. We can't protect ourselves well enough. So the curious thing is that we could immediately spiritualize this, right? We can immediately spiritualize this and say that this is sin. This is sin. We want money more than we want God. I think that's a place people go. But I think that's an oversimplification. Because most of us, I find, again, most of us don't want to like earn money and have all the stuff just for its own sake. I really don't think we do. Most of us, many of us now, start from this place, a lot of folks start from this place of entering their adult life with lots of debt. They or their parents have lots and lots of college debt. So if you're like, yeah, I'm the parent, I have lots and lots of college debt, right? Or I'm still paying off that lots of college. So we start kind of from a negative, we're behind the starting line when we start. But most of the people that I know who struggle financially don't struggle financially because like they tried to buy this house that was way beyond their means or drive too many cars that are way beyond their means. They struggle because of one of two things, at least one of two things. A huge change in the economy, local or national, that shook things up, resulting in underemployment or unemployment, and or a medical crisis. So many people I know struggling financially because of a medical crisis. And you do anything. You pump everything into that because that's life and death and quality of life for you and your loved ones. And there is nothing sinful or wrong about that. There is nothing sinful or wrong about trying to protect and preserve our families. keep ourselves fed and clothed and housed and healthy. In fact, that's a sacred thing. So we don't want to demonize that. We don't want to say that what happens to the people of Israel when they're in the desert, when they're in the wilderness, they've come out of Egypt, and Moses has gone to talk to God and then hasn't come back. And they're waiting. And that they just decide that like a golden calf is going to be a better God for them. They just decide that in some flash of mob mentality, sinful moment, and they make money their God. What that really comes from, I think, really comes from is their worry, is their anxiety, is their sense of needing someone and something to trust. And it's really hard to trust in someone and something they can't see, whether that's God or that's Moses who's speaking for God. And so they're grasping at something that will feel secure. The deeper inner question is not a question of, oh, these are bad people or we're bad people when. The deeper inner question is, how do we get through this time of uncertainty? How do we get through this moment where we don't know who to follow or how to live our lives or what this is going to be like? Where do we place our trust? And they make a bad choice about that. But it comes from a very human, very real experience. So we end up underwater, and we sink deeper and deeper, and it's really all about trust. It's really not all about money. It's really not all about what we try to trust in. It's really all about the fact that we need someone and something to trust. But instead, we're left to our own devices. And so here are some statistics about those devices. We enter the wonderful trap of credit, the wonderful trap of debt. Again, already probably underwater from some college loans, if you're like myself. And then come the credit cards. Very easy to get a credit card for anybody. Very easy to get a mortgage for just about anybody. It used to be. We've gotten a little bit better about that, a little bit stronger about making sure people can actually pay back what they borrow. But I remember one commercial a few years ago. It was like this, nice middle-class guy, you know, living the good life, watering his lawn, mowing his lawn or whatever. And he says in the commercial, like, how do I do all of this? And he goes, has this, like, kind of deer in the headlights look on his face. And he says, I'm in debt up to my eyeballs, right? You remember that one? It's like Lending Tree or something, right? It's like that, right? The average American household in 1990 had a credit debt of $3,000. That's average. And there are lots of households that don't have any. So that's the average. In 2008, the average American household had a credit card debt of $9,000. And today, it's actually the average American household has credit card debt of about $7,500. We've improved. There's some consumer protections that have helped with that. But the website I was reading was clear that actually the biggest change is that a lot of that debt has been defaulted on. So that's not necessarily a good thing. Also, I'm usually proud to say that I'm above average, but this is not a place where I want to be. But confess that I am above average in this area. We also know that the thing about credit is that it makes it easier to do more with it. They found that the purchase price one will pay for something is 125% higher if you can put it on your credit card than if you pay by cash. Because when you pay by cash, you've got like actual money that you're handing over, so you're really thinking about it. But when you put it on a credit card, we're more likely to spend, and spend drastically more, 125% more. And again, this is a brokenness that is systemic, because it does, I think it comes from two places. It comes from that trust in us that is missing or, you know, longing for something. And it comes from a place, a kind of cultural communal place. A systemic justice or injustice place where we've kind of set up the world in such a way now that it's really hard. It's really hard to pay down expense, and it's really hard to be free of that. A lot of people who don't want us to be free of that, they get a lot of money out of it when we're not. And it comes from a place where we devalue one another. That's what I really think we're doing. When we worry so much about what we do and what we pay and what stuff we have, and just being able to have enough, and that's not something that we all can kind of share in, but we're sort of like, whew, there, but for the grace of God go I, when we see someone suffering sometimes. That place, That's a culture that's broken. That's a culture that's systemically hurting. I think that means that we have given someone and something way too much power. Way too much power. We can call it a golden calf. We can call it the need to keep up with the Joneses, but I don't really think it's that. We can call it the need to feel safe and secure and like we're going to be okay. But even that, we've given too much power. Too much power. And that then becomes what controls us. When I'm afraid, this is the truth. When I'm afraid about how to make ends meet, when I'm afraid about where I'm going to take from here or there to pay that bill over there, I'm not my best, strongest, most loving, most generous self. I'm not. I'm scared. Coming from a place of fear. It's real. It's set up in our culture to be necessary, but it is fear. And when I'm living in that place, someone else is controlling me. And you know what? I believe in a God who sent Jesus Christ so that we might have life and have it abundantly. I believe that. But in that moment when I'm afraid, I'm not living that. I'm not living abundant life. I'm coming from a place of fear. This is the problem that the Israelites were facing in the desert. Fear. Who's going to lead us? Who do we trust? And this is the problem that Jesus was speaking to his disciples. This is nothing new. Do not worry, he says. Do not worry about what you will eat or drink or wear. Doesn't that sound nice? Sometimes sounds impossible. Sometimes sounds really hard. I went to Kohl's to go get the kids winter coats the other day. I left Kohl's without winter coats. Whoa! It's cold outside. Want to make sure that my kids are warm. But not for $110 for a winter coat. No, thank you. Do not worry about what you'll wear. Well, that sounds nice. But I'm worried. I'm worried about what they'll wear to stay warm. Jesus reminds us that God is the one that provides. That God, in God's abundance, provides for the animals, for the flowers, in not just that they live, but that they live beautifully. There's a beauty and a delicacy to the flowers, the lilies of the field. There's nothing austere and tight and fearful about the way that they bloom. Do not worry, he says, and that sounds beautiful. And what I have found, this is such a strange inverse relationship. What I have found is that the harder the moment financially, the harder the moment emotionally and personally, the deeper the trust I need to have in God to get through it. You found that? Jody was speaking to that earlier, right? The harder the moment, the more we've lost, the more we're afraid of, the deeper the faith we need in someone or something, and friends, it might as well be God, to get through that moment. Because anything else we put in that place, any other something that we put there and we put our trust in, is going to be the thing that controls us or that becomes our subject of worship. But when we put God in that place, when we say, okay, there's really literally no way I can get through this without you, the more we trust, the freer we feel. It's really strange. It's really strange. But I have experienced this. The more afraid I am about how to make ends meet or how to get through an emotionally challenging moment, the more I have to say, okay, God, I can't do this alone. I need you to do this. Show me how to do this, or just walk with me through this. And the more free I feel from that moment, the less controlled, the less afraid, the less pushed into a tiny, confined little box, or the less like I'm having that chase dream that I can never get away from, the more free I feel to live the abundant life that Jesus calls us to live. How do we do this? Because this is what sounds really good. How do we not worry about what we will eat or drink or wear or how we will make ends meet? It starts with what we would call theologically confession. Knowing that this is a problem. Knowing that this is part of our world. Making a change in our lives, and that's what we're going to be talking about for the next few weeks, the changes that we can make in our lives practically and spiritually to address that. making a change in the world around us, because I do believe that this is a systemic thing, and so our involvement in things like the United Valley Interfaith Project, which seeks greater economic justice for people in our area, is part of how I also hand this over to God, right? And there are lots of ways that we can learn about that and do that, including the MICA Awards tonight. And by deepening our spiritual dependence on God, our trust in God in all matters, the more I need God, the more free I am. It is a strange but true phenomena in my life. What do I want to be when I grow up, as I still grow up? I want to be debt-free. Oh, yeah, that sounds good. I want to be worry-free. That sounds even better. I want to be freed to trust in God and God alone. And that would free me to rejoice, to live a life of simplicity, but of hope and of joy, free to be generous, free to be alive and having abundant life, free to dream not of what I would do, but of all who God calls me to be. So join me in this journey these next few weeks as we think about the changes we'll make in our hearts, in our lives, in our world, placing our trust in God and being set free. Amen.